Yes.
Really non-controversial.
Afternoon, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call us to order. Calling to order the Senate Committee on Commerce. We have a very, very active day today. Besides that, the chair is going to be stepping out momentarily to go give testimony in another committee. So we're going to be running through some stuff. I want to go through a couple of bills that were on the schedule that we are not going to be taking action on today. They will be carried over until our next, which will be our last meeting a week from today, Wednesday, May 30th. Those two bills are House Bill 2205A and House Bill 2944A. If you're here on either of those two bills, you don't need to stay. And we'll see you next Wednesday if you want to still have interest in those two bills. With that said, what we will be doing is we're going to be working through the agenda. And I'm going to go ahead and call a public hearing to order on House Bill 2256. And Ms. Braun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2256A allows employees to be paid through direct deposit, automated teller machine, payroll card, or other means of electronic transfer. If employee can withdraw entire amount with no penalty, choose another method of payment, or revoke the agreement within 30 days of giving notice, authorizes civil penalty.
And I have two people signed up at this point on the schedule, and those are Dan Gardner and it looks like Nargis Shabes. I apologize, I just can't read the writing. And it's not your fault, it's probably mine. So, Mr. Gardner, we're going to let you get started, and I said I will be back, and so we'll have Senator Bach in handling.
Want
to just come down here?
Yeah, I'll just come down here, so I'm not sitting all the way down here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry. House Bill 2256A is an electronic paycheck bill. This particular one authorizes an employer to issue an employee a debit card or electronic payment device for payment of wages in essence, allowing Oregonians to enter the 21st century when it comes to paying their employees. Actually, studies show that there are over 2.2 million workers nationwide currently using this method of payment. There's about nine different states that have legislation on it, several others that are working on it. In essence, what the bill does is says that for your paycheck, current law says if you're paid a paper paycheck, one cannot charge you for cashing your paycheck, a bank of origin where the check is issued by the employer. This is saying basically the same thing. You get one time to go to the bank to get every single penny of your paycheck through an electronic format without being charged a bank fee. We worked out the bill with the Bankers Association. There's no known opposition to the bill. There is A3 and A5 amendments. The A5 amendments are the ones that we're supporting. It basically says that on the amendments that the agreement has to be in the language of the person, the employee that's getting the electronic paycheck. I think it's incredibly important that the employee understand all of the parameters around electronic paychecks. It also allows for seasonal workers a 10-day period to revoke the agreement for seasonal farm workers, those who also work. The A3s don't add the and different plants that is in the A5 amendments. So it's really for those type of seasonal workers. There's a shorter time frame and this particular specification that the written notice has to be in the language of the particular employee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe.
So if we approve the A5 amendments, we don't need the A3?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, absolutely. With the A5s, you would not need the A3. The A5s just arrived a minute ago. All the A5s do is the same as the A3, except for it adds the language employed in packing, canning, freezing, and drying of any variety of agricultural crop, so that it also includes those in that category.
Any other questions? Thank you. Is that Nargis?
Good afternoon. My name is Nargis Shadbe. I'm the farm worker director with the Oregon Law Center. I know that you have a packed room, and I'll just come to the point. I have represented migrant seasonal farm workers for over 20 years. If you have any questions that focuses on the application of this bill to those workers, I'm here to answer those. And I just wanted to highlight that the bill would be a lot more workable and useful for both the workers and their employers if the Dash 5 amendments were adopted, because as we have noticed, especially of late in the past few years, the demographics of agricultural workers in our state has changed dramatically, and a lot of the workers are not able to read or write in Spanish either, so the oral revocation is critical. Also, there's the time period recognition that the notice given to the employer and for the employer to then make the adjustment from one method of payment to the preferred method by the employee requested is 10 days instead of 30, in recognition of the fact that workers get paid, the pay periods are shorter than 30 days.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add that, you know, this bill passed out of the House on a 59-0 vote. There is no known opposition to the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Monroe.
The issues in the A5 amendments, were they raised in the House, or are they something that has come up after passage in the House?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, they have come up since the House, although we've had conversation with some of the folks in the House, and there seems to be no opposition from the you know, the people on the committee I've talked to so far over there.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else wanting to testify on House Bill 2256? See no one? I want to bang the hammer and close the public hearing and
open a work session.
Leave the board.
You don't need the board.
Open work session, House Bill 2256.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
Move the Dash 5 amendments to 2256.
Senator Monroe has moved Dash A5 amendments into House Bill 2256. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Monroe.
Move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved House Bill 2256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on motion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Monroe, would you like to carry it?
Okay.
Okay. Close the work session. And now we'll open a work session on House Bill 2258. And we have Dan Gardner, please. And Anna, would you like to introduce the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2258A requires upon notice of a wage payment error, employer must pay amount less than 5% of wages to employee within 1 day. If amount is more than 5% of wages, the employer must pay within 3 business days. There is no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. In essence, House Bill 2258, the bill, if passed, is meant to require employers to correct payroll errors and underpayments of 5% or greater of gross pay within 3 business days. Errors, other than that, would take to the next regular scheduled payday. Current law does not specifically address this situation. This has come up with the Bureau a number of times where a large error on someone's paycheck that is not, that's the fault of the employer, and even admittedly the fault of the employer, has to wait an extended period of time. So this bill corrects that. It allows, provides bully to require an employer to post a bond when it determines the employer has failed to pay the wages within 5 days of payday schedule. It actually takes care of these errors and omissions and This bill also passed out of the House on a 56-0 vote and has no known opposition.
When you say a number of times, can you give me an idea what you mean by that?
By a number of times...
You said that this issue has been brought forward a number of times.
Well, we get complaints about it constantly, and, you know, we get calls from employees who say, hey, there was a mistake by the employer, and they don't want to correct it till the next payday, which is close to a month away in general situations, and it amounts to about half of my paycheck or 25%. We get, I mean, roughly... anecdotally, I can tell you I've heard of about probably 100 phone calls in the last couple of years that relate to these type of errors and asking us what the law is and is there protection within it. We simply can send a demand letter to the employer stating that they must pay it, but there is no time frame in current law that actually shows them within what period of time. The intent of the bill is if it's a small amount of the person's paycheck, then it can wait till the next payday. If it's a large amount of the person's paycheck, they need to pay their bills, and that needs to get to them in a shorter period of time.
Any other questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2258? No one. Close the public hearing. Open work session. House Bill 2258.
Move 2258A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Boston has moved House Bill 2258 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion of the motion. Objections. Carried. Boston will carry it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Close the work session. House Bill 2258. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2460, and a whole bunch of people had wanted to talk about the bill, and now they've all changed their mind. Apparently, is Representative Rosenbaum here?
Actually, that's one of the ones that the chair wanted to be here for.
Oh, okay. Hold on to that one. What else we got?
60 and 85 were the two.
Okay. I was just holding on for the work session.
Okay, we will.
Okay.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2460, and we will open a public hearing. What about 2622?
Yeah, that's good.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2622. And we've got a little paperwork going up here. And Ms. Braun, you wish to
start
with the bill?
I'm not finding that to sign. Oh, nobody signed up for this one.
Nobody signed up for the
I
bill?
Is there
a sign-up sheet that no one signed up for? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2622.
Should I?
Can we have Anna tell us what it's about?
Yeah, I could tell you what it's about if you'd like.
Oh,
if
nobody cares enough to come.
I think it's Senator Nelson's bill.
Sorry about that.
Committee on Business and Labor.
Oh, I'm thinking the wrong one.
This is prohibits the Oregon Youth Authority employees to have custody control or supervision of youth offenders from striking. Yes, Mary Botkin, I think, wanted to testify on this bill.
Hey,
soon you lose.
Too late. You're coming forward now after the public hearing is closed?
Are you reopening it, sir?
Reopen the public hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anna, would you please describe the bill to us?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2622 prohibits Oregon Youth Authority employees who have custody control or supervision of youth offenders from striking. It has no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do sincerely apologize. I was down in another hearing and neglected to get signed up on this sign-up sheet. I'm sorry. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent the parole officers who work for the Oregon Youth Authority. They are the only unit of parole supervision type officers left in the state that are not prohibited from striking. They're currently in PERS, they're in police and fire, This will have no effect on them economically. It is simply a alternative resolution for disputes. With me is Colleen Savage, who is our staff rep and chief bargainer for the Oregon Youth Authority. And she shares in my embarrassment, and I apologize to my colleague for that as well. Anyways, I will just sit back and let her also speak to you or answer any questions.
I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
State your name for the record, please.
Colleen Savage, Oregon AFSCME.
And you have no other testimony you don't want to?
We asked that this bill be presented to you for consideration because the parole and probation officers of OYA are dealing with some very interesting individuals now. And we believe it is truly an issue of public safety to have them non-strikeable.
Fine by me.
Mr. Chair.
There we go.
May 23rd. 2007, a date which will live in infamy. The union has come before us, asking us to prohibit their members from striking. Mark it down, folks.
Well, I would argue, Senator, that the unions have been here many times in the past on public safety to ask for this. But I would like to know, in the past, I mean, how many strikes have there been by this work group?
Mr. Chair, there have been no strikes. We have settled all of our disputes.
Members of the committee, we have a very good working relationship with the Oregon Youth Authority, and this really just brings them into alignment with the rest of the public safety community. This has sort of been overlooked. And we just decided that this was the session to sort of bring it back into focus. We introduced it last session, and it just did not move last session in a timely manner. It moved, but just not in a timely manner, and got hung up in the House at the end. And so we're just asking this time to move it forward.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gorley.
Thank you. What are the interesting issues that you refer to that we should be aware of, perhaps, that relate to this measure?
Well, Mr. Chair, committee members, the folks, the youth that the parole and probation officers are serving are coming out of all of the OYA facilities, or they have been placed on probation by the courts. And these folks, a lot of them now are Measure 11s, whereas 10 years ago when I started working with this group of employees, we had car theft, we had some physical assault. Nowadays, those are the minor crimes. And to characterize the youth as they were 10 years ago is way beyond where we are now. So we felt as an organization and as a group of employees that being strike prohibited, we could continue to bargain successfully, but that we would also be able to continue our job if a dispute did arise between us and the employer.
Well, I appreciate your response to the question. Your response helps us lay down a more complete record in this committee of why it is we need to have this public policy in place. So I appreciate your response.
Thank you.
Mary, the bill speaks to youth authority employees who have control, custody, supervision of youth offenders. But you're testifying on probation.
I'm sorry, parole. This would be parole only.
I misspoke.
It is parole only.
It's parole only, but so are the current workers who are at McLaren and other youth affiliates, they're already prohibited from striking?
Yes.
So this, because if you look at, you have guards at correctional institutions or mental hospitals, which are the people in the facilities, and then you have parole probation officers who supervise adult offenders.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this language include parole? Because is that the supervision word?
Yes.
Okay.
The parole officers in the youth system have control, custody, and supervision duties of youthful offenders while they're on parole. So the youth that we supervise actually have to check in and be, they must be responsive to a parole plan and the parole officer who is placed in charge of them.
How many of these workers are there?
100 statewide.
100 statewide. Mm-hmm. The Senate Bill 400, which passed both chambers and is now law, because I believe the governor signed it, does that apply to only non-strikeables, or does that apply to all public safety workers?
All public safety.
So even public safety workers that are allowed to strike are covered by Senate Bill 400. So the passage of that would not, this would not change that at all. Okay. You else have anything? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf of this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2622.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill
2622.
Open work session. House Bill 2622.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2622 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Gordon moves House Bill 2622 to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Objections? Ordered. Senator Gordley, would you carry the bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Close work session. House Bill 2622. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2635.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2635 adds grandparent or grandchild to the definition of family member for purposes of family leave. It has no revenue impact. The fiscal statement is issued, and there are two amendments, but I think the advocates don't like the amendments so far. So,
thank you.
Let me read them. George Okolich.
George Okolich and Felicia, is it Higgins? Come forward first, please. Someone else with us. Ms. Berger. Who would like to start?
Chair, Byron, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Higgins, and I'm here representing the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, Local 503 and Local 49. We're here today in support of this bill of expanding family leave to include grandchildren. Many of our members are the primary caregivers for their grandchildren and have been encouraged by the state to do so. So this is a good one. We hope that members of this committee can support it.
Go ahead.
Vice Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Okolich, here on behalf of the Oregon Travelers Association. We come in support of 2635 as originally drafted, but we are here specifically to talk about the amendments. There's the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments are what we requested Legislative Council to draft. Our basic intention behind that was to sort of codify sort of some existing practice in terms of not allowing an employer to retaliate against somebody who uses family leave, or not allow an employer to prohibit someone from discussing family leave with them. We think this is a good policy. There's a Court of Appeals case that deals with it, and we think it's important that the legislature just acknowledge that Court of Appeals case and sort of codify that rule in statute. So we would ask you to, unfortunately, the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 amendments don't go there. The original intention was, there are obviously current cases right now in the process. The Dash 1 amendment, if it went into effect, would simply say that all those cases are moot because the current law right now, which what they're acting under, is not law. So we attempted to try to say, you know, it needs to happen emergency clause. That's what the Dash 2 attempts to do. Unfortunately, that doesn't work into the Dash 1, and so we need to sort of come back to you with a sort of a dash three that tries to put these two concepts together in something that's, that works. So,
questions? Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Patty Risberger, also on behalf of the Oregon Trialawyers Association. I've been practicing law for over 5 years exclusively in the employment area representing employees. We're certainly in favor of a retaliation provision which merely codifies existing law. In 2004, the Court of Appeals decided the Yeager decision, which recognized that the legislature does has statutorily authorized a retaliation claim. The problem, however, is that it isn't as clearly codified as it could be. Our concern with the Dash 1 proposal amendment is that it applies only appears to apply only prospectively. I have some clients that come in the door, just came in the door the other day, and if this statute merely applies prospectively, in effect, it could be construed as meaning that client doesn't have a retaliation claim, a statutory retaliation claim. So based on Yeager, there is such a claim. I want to make sure that we don't go backwards in the law here. And possibly the Dash 1 amendment would do that. So we would ask for some more time to succeed with the retaliation codification and clarify the law in this area.
Questions from the committee? Would you like to testify to the amendments?
Felisa Higgins, SEIU. We're supportive of a retaliation prevention clause. We'd like to see them come together so that we don't go backwards in the law as well. So.
Mr. Chair.
Sam Monroe.
This committee has one more meeting date, my understanding. Are you going to be ready before that?
We'll be ready.
Okay.
Okay, that's good. Sorry. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2635? Seeing no one, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2635. And I'm sensing that the committee members want to hold the bill.
Fine by me.
Mm-hmm. I'm not voting for any of this. Fine by me to hold it forever.
Mr. Chair, I guess I should say a little more than a nod of the head. I'm very interested in this bill. I definitely want to see it pass, so I would ask our committee administrator to make sure it gets scheduled next time we meet.
Okay, there you go. Well, there's the opinion of one committee member.
Oh, I am also
I'm not saying he is the only one. I just said that is the committee opinion of one.
Just to be clear.
Okay. We open a public hearing on House Bill 2261.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2261A modifies the membership of the State Apprenticeship and Training Council and establishes minimum qualifications. There is an A2 amendment which establishes an emergency clause. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Dan Gardner.
Okay, Dan Gardner. And somebody else looks like.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and with me today is Steve Sims, the head of the Apprenticeship and Training Division. House Bill 2261 comes before you from the Apprenticeship and Training Council, which has a long history of supporting apprenticeship training. Basically, within this bill, there's a few simple modifications and I believe I'll let Mr. Sims explain.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, committee members, Stephen Sims, Administrator for the Apprenticeship and Training Division. The bill basically does three things, and one takes care of a number of housekeeping issues, grammatical errors, language, trying to simplify the language of ORS Chapter 660. The two substantive matters involve a change in the composition of the State Apprenticeship and Training Council. Currently, the council has 11 members, the Labor Commissioner, and 10 additional members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the state Senate. Currently, four members represent the industrial trades and occupations, four members represent the construction trades and occupations, and two members represent the public. The industrial and trade construction trade members must be equally divided between representatives of employers and representatives of employee interest. House Bill 2261 retains the four council members from the building and construction trades, but it also eliminates the four members from the industrial and manufacturing trades. In their place, there would be two members representing non-building trades occupations that could, in fact, include manufacturing, but they can be from any trade or occupation that has apprenticeship programs approved and registered by the State Apprenticeship Council. There would be one individual representing employers and one representing employees in this scenario. The two public members are retained, and the total number of members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate would be reduced from 10 to 8. This change is proposed not to diminish the importance of the industrial and manufacturing trades in the state, but to more accurately reflect the actual participation in registered apprenticeship. For more than a decade, the construction trades have accounted for more than 80% of the apprentices registered with the State Apprenticeship Council. It is construction-oriented. The bill does, as I stated earlier, would allow for industrial and manufacturing representatives, but it would not dedicate four seats to them. This proposal was thoroughly vetted through the State Apprenticeship Council and the apprenticeship community in a process that began in 2003. We've received only one written request to retain all four industrial members, and after debate within the apprenticeship community and the council, they felt this reduction was important. The other substantive change deals with establishing some very minimal requirements for appointment to the state council, and basically those requirements relate to some active involvement in industrial trades in manufacturing trades training, education, or workforce development. Previously, there were no guidelines requirements for the governor to follow in making appointments. This sets out some minimal guidelines for doing so. Dash one amendments in the House clarified those specific minimum requirements for participation on the State Apprenticeship Council. And also, as I came in today, I noticed there was a dash two amendment that would attach an emergency clause to House Bill 2261, and the division and the council has no objection to that clause. Thank you.
Questions? How many members are on this council now?
Mr. Chair, currently there are a total of 11 members, 10 voting members, plus the Labor Commissioner.
What? I'm trying to figure out how. That's what I thought you said, but I'm reading there's 21 on it now, plus. So.
Holy cow. We're missing a few at meetings if. What page are you on?
I'm on page 3 of the bill, section 5. The State Apprenticeship and Training Council shall consist of 11 members, including the Labor Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industry, and 10 members appointed by the governor.
And I think they're saying 11 members, including the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, so including those two.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's only 11. Those are subsets of the 11. So the commissioner.
Your attorney, I'm not. That was a bit.
I agree. I had trouble with it when I was writing my staff report. I had trouble with that. But I think it's 11 at the Bureau of Labor and Industry and 10 others.
I don't know what it means.
Well, if you add up the subsets,
Mr.
on the next
Chair,
lines, two,
if I,
two,
mean,
two,
if I were
two,
legislative three. Counsel, I would have replaced that and with consisting of, but...
I think that's probably the intent.
And consisting of would be a nice word there.
Probably the intent.
Well, Mr. Chair, that is the intent. That has always been our interpretation. We only have 11 members on the board, and the governor has never appointed more than 10.
Okay. Why do you need an emergency clause?
Mr. Chair, if I may, we did not propose the emergency clause. I assume that it came from this committee.
Looks like there's somebody behind you that did ask for the emergency clause, and he's going to tell us about it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. Prior to... Let me look at that section so I can... have the committee return to that. Prior to about 7 or 8 months ago, I wasn't aware of a practice that has begun in Oregon. We went to Steve Sims, and what it is employers who wish to set up a single employer apprenticeship program, one contractor. And I didn't think it was even legal. It turns out under federal law, you can do this. And so I went to Steve Sims, and I said, I mean, this isn't workable. The whole idea of an apprenticeship is that you work for different contractors. You learn different things within your trade. You learn different ways of doing things. And he agreed with us. And in the on the House side, the industry, and I'm talking about the ABC, AGC, and the building trades, all asked that the amendment be put in the bill on page 5, line 39. I'm told that's what the language is, was added on the House side that clarifies it that if you're going to be a training agent in the building trades, you can be approved by this council only as a group program serving multiple employers, which is what the ABC, AGC, and the other union programs do now. So we want to stop the growth of single employer apprenticeship programs, which really can't function. I mean, where are you going to get the instructors and develop the curriculum so the apprentices really are trained? And so we put the emergency clause on there. Because
what is a single employer apprenticeship program?
That would be a contractor who goes to the council and says, I want to be a training agent just myself. As a one person, like in my organization, we have, what, probably 100 electrical contractors just in the Portland area, all grouped together. They have a joint committee run by labor and management jointly. And that's typical of how the industry operates. But now we've got people who want to form a one-employer committee, essentially. I don't even know how it would work. But apparently the feds say you can do it. And we just think it's a very bad public policy to allow this to happen.
So you're not talking about a company who has one employee, one journeyman electrician, say, that can get one apprentice?
Technically, I think they could.
No, I mean, and that's what you're trying to stop?
Yeah. As one committee. They're free to join all the group programs now. That's what, in fact, we encourage that.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could. You know, it's you've got three. You have to have at least four companies, electrical contractors or roofers or whatever, to you know, multiple employers coming together to do all of the training.
Right.
Is what the effect of this bill is. One company who has three employees can't just suddenly start up their own apprenticeship and training program, which you'd have to develop curriculum for. You'd have to have the curriculum approved by the Apprenticeship and Training Council. You'd have to then, you know, find a training facility, hire an instructor, and all the rest of it. No single individual employer can logically afford to do that and do an adequate job.
Right. Mr. Chair.
Senator Borley.
Thank you. But, Mr. Shipwreck, did I hear you say that this is a practice that is allowed by the federal government and allowed by which entity are we speaking of?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gould, I'd prefer if you ask that of Steve. He's the expert on this. He's the guy we went to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley. All registered apprenticeship programs in individual states have to be approved by the United States Department of Labor Office of Apprenticeship Services. Our state council has been approved by that body. The federal regulations on apprenticeship state that there are four different types of apprenticeship programs. Single employer programs run solely by the employer. There are group programs where multiple employers band together. There are group joint programs where a number of employers have a joint employer-employee apprenticeship program with input on both sides. And then there are single employer joint programs. in the state of Oregon, in the building, I'm sorry, in the manufacturing and industrial trades, I take that back, in all apprenticeship programs, by current language in ORS 660, all of our programs have been joint. The legislature decided in 1937, when Oregon adopted the second apprenticeship law in the state, that if you're going to do this type of training, you will have input from labor, you will have input from the employee. So all of our programs are joint. In the building, I'm sorry, in the manufacturing trades, we do permit single employer programs because of the nature of the work. If I'm working for Boeing, Boeing is large enough, they don't need other employers to train people to become a machinist or a tool and die maker. So we allow that in the industrial manufacturing sector. In the building and construction trades, because of the nature of the building and construction trades, i.e., let's talk about operating engineers. That's expensive training. Iron worker is expensive training. It is difficult for a single employer to in a construction industry to bear the cost of that training. Secondly, because the nature of the construction industry is to work yourself out of a job, in a single employer program, once that apprentice has worked with their journey worker and they've completed the job and there is no more work, we don't want that apprentice out of work. We want them to go to their group apprenticeship committee, and they go on a list of out-of-work apprentices. They're assigned out. So having multiple employers keeps the individual working. And finally, and probably most importantly from a training standpoint, if you have a single employer program with one single journey worker and that apprentice is stuck there, they're only going to learn the industry through that eye, the eye of that one journey worker. Our council prefers in the building and construction trades that you rotate through different employers to see you through times of unemployment and to work under with the supervision of a variety of journey workers. And further, it is more cost effective given the cost of the building and construction trades programs. Those of you who have been to some of the training centers know that they've built training centers that rival small community colleges. The only cost efficient way to do that is through a group program, and that's why the amendment was proposed by Mr. Shipwreck.
I have a follow-up question.
Go ahead, Senator.
One of you said that the intent here is to stop the growth of single employer programs. I believe I heard that. Mr. Shipwreck said that. So how many programs are we talking about?
I'm aware, Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I'm aware of two, but they've happened very recently, and we just want to stop this before it gets out of hand.
Are there other states who allow the practice?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, other states do allow that practice.
If I may follow up, is there any kind of, I'm not an attorney, but is there any kind of liability in denying an employer this opportunity? Any legal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I think, first of all, I want to make sure that we all understand every employer who is qualified is entitled to join an apprenticeship program. Your very specific question is there any liability to denying an individual employer the right to have their very own apprenticeship program?
That's the question.
And I don't believe that there is, as long as it's authorized by statute. Again, in Oregon, the statute makes the distinction that all of our programs shall be group programs, labor management. So therefore, there's no liability if we turn down just an employer without that joint labor management participation for a committee. I think what Mr. Shipwreck is getting at with this amendment is that we, in fact, have one single employer program in this state right now, which was granted because of some exceptional circumstances about 5 years ago. Another employer has made the same request in the same trade. And so what he is saying, I felt that 5 years ago we didn't have the legal authority to say you have to be, we could say you have to be group, but we couldn't say that, or joint, but we couldn't say you have to be a group program. We want to make sure that that practice that in the past, other than the one prior exception, continues to be the case, that the council can continue in the building construction trades to require that we have group programs.
A final question. Mm-hmm. Can you name the employers that we're talking about and where are they located?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordon Lee, I certainly can. The first program was a light grading and paving program for Morris Brothers. They were approved again approximately 5, maybe 6 years ago. The new applicant, and they're not new anymore because we've accommodated their needs, is... And now my memory's failing me. Can you recall that?
Wasn't it Hap Taylor?
Hap Taylor in Bend, Oregon. Now, in working with Hap Taylor, we found out that they were a part of a subsidiary that also owns Morris Brothers and also owns another light grading and paving company in the region. And we, in talking to the three affiliates, all jointly owned, we said, wouldn't it be more efficient for you to have a joint program for all three of your facilities? The exact goal of mandating group membership in the construction industry, when we talked to them about it, they said yes. And so at our last council meeting, we approved a joint program with all three of those affiliates. I believe the parent company is called Knife River, Inc. So we've addressed it so far. Technically, after our council meeting next month, it'll be appropriate to say we have no single employer programs in the building and construction trades because that group will be consolidated.
Thank you.
Certainly.
When you're talking about you described you want this apprenticeship or the apprentice going from employer to employer to employer. Mm-hmm. There's not a requirement that they do that.
No, there isn't.
No, Mr. Chair, there's no requirement to do so. It is in the general belief of the Apprenticeship and Training Council that is best for an apprentice to get a well-rounded education. If you're only exposed to the practices in the construction and building trades of a single employer and how they do it for any craft, you're not getting a well-rounded experience throughout the field. It takes multiple experiences among multiple employers to really get the experience for a particular craft.
Well, I guess I don't know if I agree with that statement, and maybe are linemen part of your apprenticeship program?
Mr. Chair, the linemen are considered to be industrial programs.
Is that covered by this?
No, it's not a building construction trades program.
But regular electricians are?
Yes, wiremen, yes.
Yeah, I know lots of electricians that they become apprentice and they go to work for a single employer. They do their entire apprenticeship with that employer. When they get done, they go to work for that employer and they work their entire career there.
Mr. Chair, that does happen. And as a former electrical apprentice myself, I can tell you I've known people who have done that. I also can tell you as a licensed journeyman electrician that doesn't give you the best well-rounded experience because what you see is just how that employer does things, what type of equipment that employer uses, what process and procedure that employer uses. Other employers use different things. You get a better rounded experience with the full flow. It doesn't mean you won't be a good electrician. It just means that you'll have a more broad experience. And by sharing that experience throughout different employers, it actually makes for a better industry.
Is there an attempt of the passage of this bill would change that and require people to move from one employer to another?
Mr. Chair, absolutely not.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think the most accurate way to state it, if you looked at an apprenticeship standard, it would state here are the 5, 6, 10 work processes during the course of your apprenticeship that you must have experience in. If a single employer within a group program can say, I can give my apprentice work experiences in all 10 of those areas, then of course we would never even ask them to move them elsewhere. If that employer cannot provide all 10 of them, then we ask them to work with their committee to make sure that they double up in their classroom related instruction. If that employer that you speak of only does residential and no commercial electrical work, then you better make sure that you've increased your classroom instruction on commercial threefold. Our goal is to get individuals experience in all phases of the occupation so they can move throughout different areas of the industry. But no, we could not force or mandate an employer to move someone we would simply require the apprenticeship committee to make allowances to make sure they're fully trained in all phases of the occupation.
Well, they have to get experience in industrial and commercial and residential in order to card out.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if their employer doesn't offer that, if they're working for an employer that doesn't offer that, they have to go somewhere else.
Correct.
If they're
Absolutely.
Working for a large employer who has all of those
yes.
areas.
Okay.
One more question.
Senator Gordley.
Do the current standards of apprenticeship say explicitly that that an apprentice must move around in the way in which you're describing and defining?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, no, they do not specifically say that. The standards state, and I'm paraphrasing, that an apprentice is expected to be trained in all aspects of the occupation as set forth in the program standards, that the apprenticeship committee is expected to work with its employers to ensure that all training takes place. Words to the effect that understanding that is not always the case, that our office, the apprenticeship division, will review individual apprenticeship files to make sure that additional classroom training has taken place when the apprentice has not been able to be rotated through all aspects of the occupation. And that's what we do in our compliance reviews. If we find that an apprentice for electrical, for example, has only got one-tenth of the hours they need in commercial, then we're going to make sure they've taken a ton of other commercial hands-on classes to make up for that lack of on-the-job training.
Any questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to testify? All right.
Nope.
Apparently not. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2261.
Hearing on this one, so we can have a work session.
Okay. I'm going to then open up a work session on House Bill 2261, and I believe we have a set of amendments that we need to consider.
Yes, there's a -A2 amendment that adds an emergency clause.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Beyer?
I was not compelled by the testimony that an emergency actually exists. In fact, they said that the situation they were concerned about has corrected itself, and the employers are not at issue anymore. So I guess I'm not compelled that an emergency exists.
I would agree with Senator Beyer on the emergency clause.
All right. And Senator Monroe, would you also be in agreement with that?
I could support it with or without the emergency clause. They asked for it. Mr. Shipback asked for the emergency clause. I would accommodate him, but
so I'm going to close the work session at this point on 2261, and we may come back to that. I just need to get up to speed on that particular one. With that said, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3400, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3400 retains the federal standard of 30 feet for fall protection for workers engaged in steel erection by repealing the January 1st, 2008 sunset provision.
All right, and we have, looks like, three people that are currently scheduled to testify on this bill: Michael Wood, Kevin Jensen, and Bob Shipwreck. If any of y'all would come forward, that'd be great. Gentlemen, whoever wants to start first.
I'll take that up. Chairman Pruszynski, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Jensen. I'm the current business manager of Ironworkers Local 29 in Portland, Oregon. I'm also an ironworker with 28 years of experience in the trade. My members performed the bulk of the steel erection in the state of Oregon. I am appearing before you to support the passage of House Bill 3400, which is a repeal of the sunset provision on House Bill 3010. Since the implementation of the federal regulations requiring relating to steel erection, subpart R, in the state of Oregon on January 1, 2004, as required by House Bill 3010, no fatalities have been recorded in the steel erection industry in the state of Oregon. In my opinion, the adoption of the federal regulations have created a safer work environment in our state and in our industry. I have provided each of you with a copy of the subpart R steel erection. I'd like to take a moment to share with you some portions of the regulation which I feel have made the steel erection industry safer for iron workers and for my members. If you would, turn to page 121, which is section 1926.752. I'm going to find it. Please note the requirements of the controlling contractor. Included is language requiring the testing of concrete in footings, piers, and walls, indicating the concrete has reached sufficient strength to support the structural steel being erected. This section also deals with modifications to anchor bolts, which hold the steel columns in place. The structural engineer of record must approve all modifications. These requirements help ensure that a collapse of the structure does not occur. Anchor bolt failure can be catastrophic. Collapse of the structure can injure or kill many workers. Also in the section under site layout is the requirement of the controlling contractor to provide adequate access roads and a firm, properly graded and drained area with adequate space for the storage of materials. This requirement of the controlling contractor provides ironworkers with a safe area to unload truckloads of structural steel and sort the individual pieces so they may be installed in the correct sequence. The importance of a firmly graded area is twofold. Sorting the structural steel and preparing for the installation of the same requires the steel members to be stood upright. An improperly graded area increases the risk of the sorted steel tipping over and injuring the iron worker on the ground. Secondly, the level work area decreases the wear and tear on the iron worker's body. The negative effects of this trade on a person's body are substantial. After 35 years of doing our type of work, it's very hard to retire with any type of good bodily functions of your knees and elbows and shoulders. This can be compounded if you are required to work on an uneven surface.
Mr. Jensen, the impact on the knees. Mr. Jensen, we have your written testimony, and it appears from what I'm seeing that you're reading verbatim. We will go through that. What I'd like for you to do is summarize it from your own heart as to the importance and why you think the bill should go forward.
I believe that the bill should go forward for what I said, is that it has made the steel erection industry safer for my members, and okay. We haven't incurred any fatalities in the previous 3 years.
That's all I'm going to ask you. The history shows that it's worked, and at this point it should move forward.
Correct.
Take the sunset off.
That's correct.
All right. Gentlemen, who else wants to give testimony?
Yes. Mike?
Thank you, Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we refer to as Oregon OSHA. You have my written comments. I will not go over those. Let me just echo what you've already heard, that there is little doubt in my mind, and I think the data nationally as well as in Oregon is compelling that the steel erection rule taken as a whole has certainly worked. What you will see in my written testimony is that looking at the specific issue of fall protection and the trigger heights addressed by House Bill 3010, we have not been able to identify data that indicates that there is a problem, either nationally or in the state. I'm also personally convinced that we've got issues of sample size, so I'm not prepared to draw a conclusion with confidence that there is not an issue. One of the practical realities is that we hear from a lot of contractors that they're enforcing fall protection at a lower trigger height in any event. The significant thing is that based on the data that we have within the state of Oregon, as well as looking at the national picture, we do not see a problem or a significant risk created by the current rule that is imposed by House Bill 3010. So although we are not able to do the data analysis that I think was anticipated when the bill was originally passed and the sunset put in place, because Federal OSHA has frankly not done the data analysis that we had expected to have completed, we don't have a reason to oppose the bill. We are therefore neutral.
All right, thank you. Mr. Shiprock, did you have anything to add?
Just one thing, Mr. Chairman. Bob Shiprock, Oregon Building Trades Council. These federal OSHA rules have made the work site better for all construction workers, because not only has it addressed the iron worker, but it also safety conditions of other people working around this activity.
All right, great. Thank you. Mr. Jensen, thank you very much for being here today. And gentlemen, thank you.
Oh, questions?
Thank you.
I apologize.
Bob, I remember this issue. Just it's like it was yesterday. I didn't know the sunset on. If I knew the sunset on, I probably would have resigned before now. You know, at the time, we heard lots of testimony, but in reality, and maybe you can't ask this question, maybe Jessica or somebody from ABC or AGC can, but a lot of the employers said they were going to require fall protection at the 8-foot or 10-foot rule anyway. Is that what's actually happening, or do you know that?
There are certain contractors and a general contractor. Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, there are certain contractors, they control safety on the site, and what the rule does, it allows you to go below the 25 or 30-foot 30-foot rule if in the decision of the general contractor that's what they want to do. Some do, some don't.
Okay, so you do have some members who are working in this arena without fall protection, and there's been no...
Well, no. Go ahead,
Chairman Brzezinski, Senator Beyer. The code also mandates that the connectors, the people working at that height, be provided with fall protection. Yeah. They have to have that fall protection available to them and wearing it. Mm-hmm. And it is with their discretion that they tie off or do not tie off at that point.
They have the fall protection, but there are some employers that are making them tie off at any time they're 8 foot out, mm-hmm. and others are not. Is that what I heard you say? Mm-hmm. And there's been no injuries, fatalities, anything recorded in the last 3 years because people have not tied off with fall protection.
Yep. Yes.
Any other questions?
All right, gentlemen, thank you again. I also understand Jessica Adamson wanted to give some testimony. Please come forward.
She does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today with the Associated General Contractors, and sadly in opposition to this bill. This is a bill that we saw 4 years ago, and AGC was opposed then and has not changed its position today. We do believe in a consistent fall protection standard at 10 feet. All other trades are at 10 feet with OROSHA, and we believe that there should be no exception to that. Many of our employers, regardless of the rule, do have trigger heights at less than 30 feet, many at 6, some at 10, to be consistent across the board. We believe it's very important for folks to do everything we can to prevent injury. And though we have no data that shows that there have specifically been injuries, thank goodness, as a result of this bill, we believe it is because most employers have been requiring tie-offs at less than 30 feet, and that has been what has kept injuries from occurring. We do like the vast majority of the SENRAC rule. We agree that it has, on the whole, done a lot to improve the safety conditions for all on the job site. But where we depart is the issue over fall protection. We do oppose this bill because we believe that folks should be tied off at 10 feet. It makes a lot of sense, and just from pure common sense standpoint, a fall at 30 feet presents very little opportunity to prevent injury or death. And we just view this as a very important safety bill and disagree with the 30-foot fall height.
All right. Ms. Adamson, I'm looking at the wrong summary, but this summary talks about just repealing the sunset that's currently in place. It has nothing to do with modifying what currently is the rule since 2003. So are you saying that you want to actually somehow oppose the bill because you think it should have the sunset continue, which is what I think is before us, or are you saying that, I mean, it just seems like it wasn't, your testimony wasn't quite as germane to what I believe the bill actually does.
Chair Prasansky, we would just as soon see the bill not happen and let the sunset take its natural course.
Okay, I got you. Okay, I understand. My apologies.
No.
All right, any other questions? I guess the same question. Do you know of any of your members who are not requiring their employees to, or their steel construction people to tie off at these lower heights?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Barr, I'm aware of none.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Monroe.
Maybe I don't understand this, not having been here before, but why aren't you coming in with an amendment to require the tie off at 10 feet instead of just opposing the bill?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Monroe, because if this bill sunsets, it will revert back to OROSHA for rulemaking, which is where we believe this issue should be, in conjunction with their advisory committees there, determining on balance what the rule should be, as opposed to putting in statute what fall heights should be.
Anything else? All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 3400? Not seeing anyone, to close the public hearing on 3400. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3400. And the chair will take a motion regarding the bill.
Move 3400 to the floor with two pass recommendations.
Senator Avakian moves House Bill 3400 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Beyer.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, in 03, this was probably this is now my sixth regular session, and I've served in six, I think, special sessions or seven. And I think this issue was the most difficult issue that I've had to deal with personally, and because I understand that, to me, it's all about worker safety. And in my mind, I can't understand how workers can be safer not fall protected at 30 feet than they are fall protected. It doesn't make sense yet. I went to the floor in 03 not knowing how I was going to vote on this bill, and I think it was one of the few times in my legislative career that I've listened to all the four speeches intently trying to figure out exactly who was right, and I ended up voting against the bill, and I still think that was the correct decision, and I still think that OROSHA should have the rulemaking ability to decide what they think is the safest for Oregon workers. So I'm going to oppose the bill because I just think that I just agree with what Jessica said, is that, you know, this is not, we shouldn't be making this decision. It should be made by the professionals. And if we let this bill sunset, this law sunset, that's, we'll go back to that.
All right, thank you. I got Senator Avakian.
Yeah, and I want to get in here too sometime.
All right, you'll be next.
Yeah, I remember the discussion from the 2003 session too. It was just amazing how big this issue got. My analysis is the same now as it was then too, and that is there's good rationale for letting OSHA make the rules. But we happen to be fortunate enough to have the very people that are doing the work and who are probably the greatest experts on how they should do their work and how they should do it safely. And they tell us that this is the way it ought to be with this bill. And I don't know of any greater information we could rely on than that.
Senator Monroe?
Yeah, and I don't have the history with it, so I have to rely on my colleagues. But I'm really troubled. I mean, the issue seems to be whether we use the federal guidelines or allow state OSHA to determine the proper rules. Is that correct? And the federal guideline in terms of height protection is looser than what the state would have. It's at 30 feet and state would be at 10 feet. But there must be some other regulations in the federal guidelines that are perhaps more restrictive because for some reason AGC doesn't like them, which seems a little strange to me. So there must be something I don't understand.
I think I can respond to that. I think the way the law says it, it's only referencing the trigger heights for fall protection mandate is the only one that is OSHA is not allowed to deviate from the federal rules, not the rest of the federal regs.
I'm seeing some head nods, so you must be correct on that.
All right. So any other discussion? We got a motion to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Objections?
One.
Senator Beyer. And so the motion carries. And House Bill 3400 will move to the floor. Senator Avakian, will you carry this one?
Oh, sure.
Would you like the chair to do this?
No, I would be happy to do it. I was scrambling for the bill to see if there was a chief sponsor somewhere, but I'm sure there's not, so I'd be happy to take care of it.
I'll tell you what. If you find a chief sponsor...
No, I'll do it. I'm happy to do it, Mr. Chair.
The Committee of Business and Labor. I think it's yours. Start assigning it to the chair. Start assigning it to the chairs of the interim committees. All right, and we're going to close the work session on 3400. And I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on 2460.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Representative Diane Rosenbaum from House District 42, and thank you very much for scheduling House Bill 2460. I'm also here in support of another bill that you have on your hearing, so if possible, if I could testify on that one too, it would enable me to go back to the busy Business and Labor Committee where we're hearing some of your good bills.
All right, so I'm going to go and open up a second public hearing for 2485 for the purpose of allowing the representative to testify on both 2460 and 2485.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, first I will talk about House Bill 2460, which I think is a bill that corrects an oversight in our legislative law, the Oregon Family Leave Law. You probably know and remember well that Oregon had some of the very first family leave laws in the country, the first parental leave laws, the first family medical leave. These became the model for the national FMLA, and so we're very proud of those laws. There is one problem currently with Oregon family leave law as it relates to workers' compensation, and this was brought to my attention by a constituent of mine who had an on-the-job injury, pretty serious injury, and found that all of her time off for her workers' comp injury was being counted against the 12 weeks that everyone is entitled to under the Oregon Family Leave Act. She got back to work after being out for several months and was told by her employer, who actually happened to be Multnomah County, that she had exhausted her Oregon Family Leave Act time because of her on-the-job injury, all of which had counted against her 12 weeks. Turned out that she had a family member that was facing a terminal illness and wasn't entitled to take any more time off, even though she had never taken advantage of family leave time previously in her career. I don't really think that that was what anyone intended. Clearly, when people are hurt on the job, they're injured through no fault of their own. That's a completely different system from the family leave laws, and I don't think that we meant for people's workers' comp time to be counted against the time off that they're entitled to take. They have a child or adopt one, or if a family member is seriously ill. And as unfortunately, in this case, that person was put in a very awkward position. We don't think that people should lose
their Oregon family leave rights, which everyone has under law because they're unfortunate enough to be hurt on the job, disabled enough to have to lose time because of it. So what the bill does is just clears up that people's workers' comp time off or time loss will not be counted against the 12 weeks that they're entitled to under the Oregon Family Leave Act. There is a dash one amendment to this bill, which came in after the bill had already passed out of committee in the House, and the Bureau of Labor and Industries is here, I think, if you have technical questions. But what the dash one does is simply make it clear that this bill does not impact people's right to reinstatement under Oregon family leave law. There was no intention on our part to give people fewer rights to come back to work because they take time off under the Oregon Family Leave Act. And there is on this amendment in section, do you have the dash one amendment in your packets? There is actually a typographical error on page 8, section 8, the final section of this amendment, which was just pointed out to me prior to the hearing. I believe this is actually a drafting error on the part of legislative counsel, but in the last line where the language says whether occurring before, on, or after the effective date of this 2007 act, it should say whether occurring after the effective date of this 2007 act. There was no intention to make this bill retroactive and say that it would apply to things that had happened before the bill passes. So I'm hoping that maybe you can just delete before, on, or, and that will take care of that. Otherwise, I suppose we would have to go back and get this amendment redrafted. But it was certainly not the intention to apply this retroactively, and the original bill does not do that. So that is my testimony on House Bill 2460, and I would be happy to answer any questions on that bill, if there are any.
Representative Rosenbaum, before we go off that amendment, I just want to make sure the language that would be needed to be deleted would be before, comma, on, or.
Correct.
Leaving occurring after in place than the effective date.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I guess actually in line 7 you would not need the word whether either because
correct.
You would no longer have a list of things, so it would just say apply to all refusals of employment under ORS 659, et cetera, occurring after the effective date of this 2007 act.
Right. Okay, we... Yeah, I think we're going to do, instead of getting into this cross-purposes with LC, let's go ahead and we'll get that amendment done.
Redrafted.
And we can bring that back, and all we'll need to do is make sure that the T's are crossed, I's are dotted, and then we'll be able to move that.
Great. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And shall I move on to the next bill?
Yes.
Okay. I'm also here in support of House Bill 2485, which also deals with the Oregon Family Leave Act, and this is a bill that had bipartisan sponsorship and also passed the House overwhelmingly with a strong bipartisan vote. What this bill deals with is that under Oregon Family Leave law, people are entitled to take time off for the birth or adoption of a child or to care for a sick child, or when a family member or themselves has a serious medical condition that requires them to be hospitalized. And under Oregon Family Leave Law, people who are lucky enough to have paid vacation time can use their paid vacation for any of the purposes that Oregon Family Leave Law allows you to take time off. But they cannot take paid sick time for any purpose other than for birth or adoption of a child. So in other words, for most of the purposes that you can take unpaid awful time off, if you have paid sick time, you can't use it. You can't use it if a family member is seriously ill. You can't use it for your own illness. But you can use it if you adopt a child or if you are pregnant and have a child. So this bill would say that if you have paid sick time, you can use it for any of the purposes that the Oregon Family Leave Law allows you to take time off. It doesn't require employers to provide paid sick leave if they don't currently do so. There's no intention here to create a new entitlement, but we do think that it's only right that if people do have paid sick time and they have accumulated it and they have somebody in their family who's dying or they have other needs that they qualify for Oregon family leave time off, that they should be able to use their paid sick time for that purpose. As I said, this bill passed unanimously out of its committee of origin in the House. It passed overwhelmingly in the House. I think it's a good bill that says that people shouldn't have to choose between their jobs and their families when they have a serious illness or other need to take time off. And without putting any undue burdens, it will allow people not to have to make that choice. So I would urge your support of House Bill 2485.
All right. Questions for the Senator Monroe?
And this bill is clean. No need for amendments.
This bill is good to go.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right.
Chair?
Yes.
I'm just looking at the House votes that are listed on our staff in the summary, and they don't exactly agree with what Representative Rosenbaum just said. So I'm just going to need a clarification.
I apologize. Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, you're right. There were two no votes in committee on the House side, but the bill did pass with 40 aye votes on the floor of the House. So I did misspeak, and thank you for correcting me.
All right. What I'm going to do is I've got a number of people that are signed up for 2460. I have only one more for 2485. Mr. Gardner, you're here. Why don't you come on up and... I'd ask that your comments be brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And to make my testimony incredibly brief, I just simply say that I'm in favor of both House Bill 2485 and 2460. They are good public policy. We should be encouraging people to spend time with their family members, when they're ill or when they, the necessity arises, and allow them every available avenue to do so. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions for the commissioner? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2485. And I guess technically I'm going to close the public hearing.
There's,
I was in another place in the building and all of the sheets have been pulled before I got here. About 3:05.
Okay.
I have very great comments.
And did you want to testify on 2485?
2485.
Okay, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on 2485.
Sorry, I was doing other things in the building. Very shortly, my name is Marcia Kelly. I represent the American Association of University Women of Oregon and our 2,000 members. We ask you to support 2485. AUW has long supported flexible workplace policies to address the family responsibilities of employees. AUW is known for its research on a national level regarding women and work, women in education, and in a recent survey, I think it was about 3 years ago, called Women at Work, surveying both men and women, we discovered that similarities between men and women do exist, particularly when it comes to what men and women want in terms of benefits versus pay. AUW's survey finds that the vast majority of men, 74%, and women, 83%, today would choose a job that pays less but provides benefits such as family leave, flexible hours, retirement benefits, and help with family care. And we think that House Bill 2485 would do those sorts of things, create a good public policy, good for workers, good for families, and good for employers.
Thank you. Any questions? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on 2485. I'm also, just for this moment, closing the public hearing on 2460. I'm opening up a work session on 2485.
I would move 2485 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I don't believe there were any amendments, were there?
There are not.
Okay.
Senator Abakian moves House Bill 2485 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll be recorded as a no.
Any other discussions? That motion carries with Senator Beyer registered as a no. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2485. I'm going to reopen the
carrier.
Senator Cordley,
We'll carry that one. We'll reopen the public hearing on 2460. And I have, it looks like, I got Steve Lanning, and then I can't tell from here if there are two people from, there's four people from Ask Me on two different lines, and then Lisa Trussell. So I've got Nijah, maybe? Nijahan? Clary?
Niwana.
And I got Colleen Savage, Joe Thurman, and Lorraine Sketch. And I'm not sure what the testimony is going to be, but we are running very short on time. We got about four more bills on these. If you want to give testimony, we'll take it. But I'm going to ask you to do, if you have written testimony, to hand that in, and not to read your testimony, but summarize so we can get on the record what we need to. That bill cannot be worked today because of the amendment that needs to be done. It is the intention of the chair to move the bill. If that gives you any indication as to where the chair is on this bill, as to maybe what type of testimony you may or may not need to give. Mr. Lanning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We support House Bill 2460, and when the amendment's sorted out, we'll support that as well. It's not a widespread problem, but we have had heard circumstances in our office of people losing family leave when they were on a workers' comp claim. So we know it's an issue that needs to be dealt with. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good job.
All right, so the other four individuals that are listed here, I'm not sure who would like to come forward to give testimony, but feel free to please come forward.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and Committee. You have a letter in front of you from...
Need you to just state your name for the record,
please. My name
please.
Is Niwana Nixon-Clary.
Oh, okay, thank you.
I'm an AFSCME Vice President for Local 1246, which represents the state-operated community programs. These are state employees. We are in favor of Senate Bill 2460 based on the fact that our safe claim times off are being used. The FMLA time is being used during that time. And we deal with some of the most aggressive MRD clients in the state of Oregon who are in our programs. And even though we learn self-defense and deflection evasion techniques, our clientele are still hurting us. If you look at the letter, there's a paragraph that talks about the injuries in the last 2 months. We've had staff off injured, had the ribs broke, people that have actually lost teeth and almost had jaws wired. We had a sexual assault not long ago, and we've had employees who, because of the aggression, have had pieces of their body parts twisted and bruised and are off on job-incurred injuries at that point. We would like to see our time used for our own personal time off that we need for our family and our kids and whatever, and not have our time used as safe time.
Thank you. And Joe?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Joe Thurman. I'm president of the Nurses Union at Oregon State Hospital. And the last data I showed that they're projecting out to be almost 300 injuries this year that are behaviorally around behaviors. And what's happening is staff are being injured, and then they're having to use their family medical leave on top of it. And I'm in support, and the nurses are in support of this bill.
Thank you very much. And
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Lorraine Sketch, and I am a psychiatrist working at Oregon State Hospital, and I've been there for almost 21 years. And I also have a medical condition that has caused me to use family medical leave in the past and enabled me to come back to work and continue working. I was surprised to find out that when a person was injured at work by an assault, that their family medical leave was being used, and I am very much in support of the bill 2460. I did not believe that if I were injured at work, that later on in the 12 months, if I were out on a medical problem, that my family medical leave should not be there to help me with that. And I've been able to work at the hospital full-time over the years, and I have had to use family medical leave, and so I think that I really support your work on this bill, and thank you for putting it forth.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions before y'all leave? Just make sure. Thank you all very much for coming forward and giving your testimony. So the only two people that I have on here that make sure, I don't know if Colleen Savage, if she's still here and wants to give testimony. Lisa Trussell? It's not necessary.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here in opposition to House Bill 2460. Employers are obligated already under the workers' comp statutes to hold a job open for up to 3 years for workers who are injured on the job. And it's unfortunate any time a worker has to be off work, whether it's for an illness or a work-related injury, or to take care of family members. But employers staff for attendance, at least in the private sector, we staff for attendance, not for absences. And just here today in this committee, there's been a couple of bills that would expand family leave, and what that does is it places a greater burden on the workers that are remaining in the workplace, and then you have issues like Commissioner Gardner brought forward earlier this session with workers working extended hours of time. Often that's because of other workers are off on OFLA. So I understand that where the chair and probably most of the committee members are, but I just wanted to point out that family leave is one of the most administratively burdensome laws that HR people deal with. And there's often times that, as in the Representative Rosenbaum's example, it wasn't the employee's own illness that they were concerned about. It was a family member's. But oftentimes what you see in the HR department is that somebody's been off an extended period of time on a workers' comp claim, and without this, they would be able to go off again for something that the employer has no way of knowing could have been corrected during the or addressed during the time they were off on the workers' comp claim. So it just extends the time off, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. And I believe that's, unless there are any questions. Lisa, thank you very much. I believe that takes care of the testimony for 2460. I'll close the public hearing on that bill, 2460. I'm going to go ahead and reopen the work session on 2261. And Senator Byron, if you want to move the bill without that amendment, which was the dash 2 on the emergency clause.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2261 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I can't find it now. But
Senator Byer moves House Bill 2261 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Yeah.
Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Nancy Monroe, would you carry this?
Sure.
One? So we'll close the work session on 2261. That leaves us with
2204 first.
2204, and are we have our?
I can't see that far.
Just 1 minute.
Oh. Okay. So 2203 first.
All right. We'll open up work session on 2203. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2203, if you'll remember, we heard on March 21st that extends the payday loan and title loan restrictions to out-of-state lenders, creates a database to track payday and title loans, allows fee to be charged to consumer for the database access. It prohibits debt collection by lender unless they are licensed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There is an 8 amendment that you received on your desk today, and that is a conflict amendment that Legislative Council has put together that resolves the conflicts between House Bill 2203 and House Bill 2204, and it also has what used to be the A6 amendment within it, which clarifies that lenders are not prevented from recovering fees from a loan default and allows DCBS to create the database but does not require it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, so that was A8.
That's the A8 amendment. They were handed out today. on the desk, so underneath all the paper.
Yeah, I'm looking. I got another one here.
There's one.
All right, and this is just basically to deal with conflicts. Nothing else in the bill needs to be...
This is the A6 amendment, which you've seen before.
Right. With?
And the conflicts.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you. Chair will take a motion on the A8s.
So moved.
Senator Abakian moves the A8s into House Bill 2203. Any discussions? Any objections? So ordered.
And 2203 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bakken now moves House Bill 2203 as amended by the A8s to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, please record me as a no.
Any Senator Beyer will be recorded as a no. Did you have any other comments that you want to put on the record?
Not this time.
Any other discussion? So ordered, with Senator Beyer being a no. And on 2203, Senator Bakken, do you want to carry this one?
Sure.
Senator Bakken will be the carrier on this one. And we'll close the work session on 2203. And looking to see, and there we go, open a work session on 2204. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2204 we heard on March 21st, and this one limits the maximum rate of interest on title loans to 36% per annum, allows a $10 origination fee for each $100 of amount loaned, prohibits loans for less than a 31-day term, prohibits more than two rollovers, prohibits making loans within 7 days of a previous loan, limits fees for dishonored checks to $20, and declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. There is an A4 amendment, and that A4 amendment adds a sale leaseback arrangement to the definition of title loans. And I believe Representative Kotek is here to speak to the A4 amendment.
All right, Representative, please join us.
Good afternoon, Chair Pozanski, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative. House District 44, which is mostly North Portland and a few sections of Northeast Portland, and very pleased to be with you today and pleased to see that you're considering House Bill 2204. This has been a major issue for me this session. Unfortunately, the amount of payday loans and car title loans that are taken out of my district is quite high, and I think anything we can do to enhance consumer protections is important. I'm also blessed this session with some very talented interns, and Galen Gamble is here with us today because she brought to my attention a potential loophole in this bill that was that hadn't been noticed. And so that is the dash A4, I believe, and I was hoping that Galen could be allowed to explain that because clearly she's the expert on the amendment. So.
That's fine, Galen. If you could walk us through this, we're actually over time, and I'm actually supposed to be giving more testimony on another bill. So if you can give us the highlights as to what we need to know on the A4s, that would be wonderful. Thank you for being here.
Chair Pozanski and other members of the committee, thanks for allowing me to testify before you today. For the record, my name is Galen Gamble. I'm a student at Portland State, and I have been an intern in Representative Tina Kotek's legislative office for the last 5 months. And the most highlighted parts, I was doing research for House Bill 2204 and other states that regulate predatory practices in car title loans. I found the loophole that HB 2204 currently leaves open by which these companies can effectively evade regulation. The A4 amendment would close this loophole. As the bill currently stands, car title loan companies will be able to avoid regulation through a maneuver known to pawnbrokers as sell-leaseback transaction. This is an agreement in which a consumer sells the car to a lender and then pays to lease the car from the lender until they eventually buy back the car. The car title lenders can evade this regulation currently included in HB 2204 because the bill limits charges on loans, and these sell-leaseback transactions are considered leases and not loans. Consumers of sell-leaseback transactions are required to sign contracts which state that the transactions are not a loan but a lease agreement, and that the consumer has no equity in the leased vehicle until the loan is fully repaid. The A4 amendment would define sale leaseback transactions as a loan as regulated by the transactions in the same way conventional car title loans would be regulated under HB 2204. According to a review of the Supreme Court of Oklahoma, a case by APLE Auto Cash Express versus the state and Oklahoma Department of Consumer Credit, an examiner for the department testified that some of these transactions, if interpreted to be loans, would the interest annual percentage rates would be 285.65%, or 290.99%, or 484.3%. In one example, the examiner investigations found that a consumer sold APL Auto Cash Express a pickup truck for $2,500 and agreed to lease it back for 156 weeks for $69 per week for a total of $10,764. This deceitful tactic has also been a problem in other states, like Oregon, have moved to protect citizens with regulating targeted short-term lenders. Alabama, Georgia, Illinois, Minnesota all authorize car title loans but specifically prohibit sell-leaseback transactions. To stop these lenders from undermining the protections of HB 2202 intended to provide, the bill should be amended with a A4 amendment to regulate sale leaseback by car title lenders. Thanks for your time.
Galen, thank you very much for preparing your testimony and giving us the overview of what the A4s will do. Any questions for our two individuals? Not. Thank you very much. The chair is willing to take a motion on the A4 amendments.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Vakin moves the A4 amendments into House Bill 2204. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
All right. First, I want to go with Senator Gordley and then back to Senator Beyer. Senator Gordley.
I would just like to say it's great to see another legislative intern from Portland State University. Great job.
Thank you.
Legislator in the making, would you say?
Absolutely. Claim your seat.
Senator Beyer.
I'll be opposed to the motion, opposed to the bill, too, but just, you know, consumer choice. People know what they're getting into, and this fixes that choice.
Any other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Procedural question. We have before us the bill sponsored by the Speaker, which caps all loans at 36%. Wouldn't it cover all of these?
Yes and no. I think there are some. I thought there were a couple of areas that were of concern, and I don't have the specifics to tell you.
Okay. I thought the kind of the plan was to go ahead and act on the speaker's proposal that would.
It's scheduled for next Wednesday.
Okay.
It's not off
and
the
it
table.
Won't. Okay. It's and it. It won't conflict with 2204?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, there are parts of of these bills that do conflict, and when these pass and when we schedule the next 2871 for next Wednesday, Legislative Council is going to be preparing conflict amendments to bring to us at that date. So that will be up to the committee whether that bill passes as well.
And I have an amendment to the Speaker's bill that I have his approval and the approval of the other sponsors on. That should I talk to you about that?
I would suggest that you get whatever you have in any of the bills that are still that are posted as of today for next week. That's our last one.
Yeah.
Anna, so she can actually make sure we know what we're doing before we get to that last day.
It's a very simple amendment that the sponsors of the bill all agree to, so I'll talk to you about that.
That'd be great. Thank you. Any other questions or statements on 2204?
This is the motion on the amendment.
Yeah. So, yeah, I know. I just want to make sure. On the motion, I should say that, on the A4.
Mm-hmm.
All right. With that, we have one objection to the adoption of the A4 amendment. So that is approved with Senator Beyer being a no. Mm-hmm. And the chairman, take.
I would like to make sure on another amendment.
Oh, okay.
I'd like to move the A5 amendments to the House Bill 2204.
Senator Barr moves the A5 amendments to House Bill 2204.
Yeah, I just said that
and thank you, Mr. Chair, committee, for closing that loophole.
Right, thank you. And regarding the A5s, Ms. Ron, do you want to give us an overview of that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A5s are on the desk in front of you as well, if you can find them on all the paper. Basically, the amendments from the Northwest Title Loans, and they delay the implementation date to July 1st, 2008.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to speak to the motion.
You bet.
Last year, during the special session, Senate Bill 1105 was passed dealing with payday lending, and it gave those lending institutions a year to dispose of their assets, cancel leases, et cetera, to close down their businesses. This amendment just simply treats the title loan lenders the same way, to give them a year to basically go get their permit from the Secretary of State to hold their coon out of business sale, I guess you might say. So I think it's just to be fair to the industry. I mean, the employees, we heard testimony, there's thousands of employees working in these places that are going to be put out of business, and just be a fairness issue to give them the same opportunity we gave the payday lenders to close down.
All right. Any other comments on the A5s?
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure I understood what you just said. Did you say that when we did this on the payday lending bill that we did a one-year wait on the implementation too, so this just mirrors that?
Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. I guess I would comment on that. Basically, since I was the architect on the Senate side for what happened during special session, we attempted to actually move the date forward. The speaker at the time was at first willing and then was not willing to modify what was called for in the actual initiative that had a date for implementation of July 1, 2007. And so what was agreed to and negotiated was that the language that was in the initiative that was being one of the driving forces, in my opinion, to have that discussion during the special session where we weren't able to complete that discussion and having a bill voted on during the regular session of 05 was the framework that we worked with, and it was determined that we would not be able to move the date sooner than what was in the initiative itself. So I would take the position that it wasn't, quote unquote, a conscious decision by the legislature to set that date. It was a date that was fixed by the initiative that was the framework for the discussions and the negotiations that myself and at that time Representative Farr were having on behalf of the two chambers. Senator Monroe?
Yeah, with this amendment, does the senator who made the motion support the bill?
That's a good question.
No. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other discussion? All those in support of the A5s? I think we need to do a roll call on this one, Brian. We'll answer aye. Those opposed will say nay or no.
Senator Bachan?
No.
Senator Gordley?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Back to me.
Vice Chair Beyer?
Aye.
Chair Prasansky?
No.
Senator Monroe?
No.
Motion fails. And are there any other amendments to be considered?
With that, I will move House Bill 2204 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bachan moves House Bill 2204 as amended by the dash A4s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any more discussion? I guess I should say.
I'll be a no.
Anyone? Any else in opposition to the motion besides Senator Beyer?
I'm going to vote in favor of the motion, but I do want to acknowledge that implementation of this public policy does mean some disruption in the lives of a lot of people, and we just need to be conscious of that fact and also acknowledge that people do need time to plan on how they're going to make adjustments in their lives.
Thank you. Just for the record, this bill gives them about 75 days because it goes into effect on July 1st, 07.
Any other comments? All right, and the motion does pass with Senator Beyer registered as a no on the motion to send the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
All right. Everyone, I want to appreciate all of your hard work today. We will have one more day that's going to be probably just as hard in the sense of length of time just because of it being our last meeting. I also want to acknowledge Vice Chair Beyer for running today most of the meeting. Thank you very much.
No problem.
And if there's any other comments, if not, we're adjourned for today. Thank you.
Thank you.